On today's episode, I'm in the Labour safe seat of Leeds Central and Headingley, set to be a supermajority of young people at the next election. I'll be talking to Alex Sobel, the Leeds MP, and Ruby Herbert, the chair of Labour Students, to find out if there are any cracks in the party's support. And for our spotlight issue of the week, I spoke to Liz Emerson from the Intergenerational Foundation to find out how bleak the future looks for young people. Hello and welcome to Pod's Own Country, the politics podcast from the Yorkshire Post. I'm Mason Boycott-Owen, the paper's Westminster correspondent, and this is Battleground Yorkshire, our new election series where I explore 12 seats in 12 weeks to find the story behind the polls ahead of the next general election. We are now a third of our way through Yorkshire's seats on my list, and today I am in Leeds, Central and Headingley. This has the potential to be the safest seat in Yorkshire for Labour, so why on earth am I bothering to come here if the polls suggest it is already a done deal? Well, it is because it is a brilliant weather vane for young people and their mood, as the youngest seat in our series. Some 40% of the seat is between 16 and 24 years old, four times the national average, and 39% of the seat are students, with six universities in the city of Leeds. Students and young people overwhelmingly support Labour, with one poll last year putting Tory support among under 25s as little as 1%. And yet, they're the least likely to vote of any age group, with any number of issues putting them off politics at large, such as the housing crisis or the Israel-Palestine conflict. Earlier, I caught up with Alex Sobel, the current Labour MP running for this seat, to find out what the main issues are facing young people. Alex, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Obviously, this is a very young and student-dominated seat, so the issues on the doorstep may be a bit different to the UK in general. What are the main problems that you're hearing at the moment?
I think number one's housing, without a doubt. So there are many different issues. We actually have a rentless reform bill coming before Parliament fairly soon, and I'm intending to put amendments down to help improve, if you like, the student experience of housing. So, for instance, many students are asked for guarantors by their landlord, and that's all very well if you come from a household with parents with means who can be a guarantor. But if you are an international student, and they might not accept your guarantor being overseas, if you're coming out of care, if you don't get on with your parents, you know, that you might not be able to get a guarantor, and that shouldn't deprive you of housing. We are seeing absolutely huge demands for deposits by some landlords. I've heard of deposits as much as a year's rent from landlords, and that we should legislate to limit deposits. Because, you know, just from a, if you get a year's rent and you're a landlord and you hold on to it for a year, what are you going to do with it? You're going to stick it in the bank and gain interest on it. That's not fair. Or, you know, and also, and lots of people just can't, it's just, you know, hugely depriving a student, say, giving, you know, well, get your whole loan out and give it to me because that's your deposit. That's, you know, it's a big issue. Then we've got issues around quality of housing. We've got issues, we've even got issues I describe as, you know, sort of false advertising. So this particularly relates to international students, that a property will be advertised, the photos won't be of that property, the floor plan will be completely different to the real floor plan, which obviously be much smaller of the property, and people are effectively buying on false pretenses. So there's a whole range of issues, of like really basic issues, which I think we can legislate on some, and the others we can look at a landlord licensing scheme. We've had voluntary licensing schemes. We have a code of standards with Unipol, which I absolutely support. But unless you make it mandatory and really implement it and really enforce it, then that won't happen. That's a big resource issue, which I understand, and I'm not sure we're quite ready for that, but that is my ideal. The second thing is generally just around finances, cost of living. We've seen absolute skyrocketing demand at some of our food banks by students. I went to Rainbow Junction about a month ago, and I didn't go around asking everybody whether they're a student or not, but it was very clear that there were a large number of those people who were at Rainbow Junction were students. And if you went to Rainbow Junction 2 or 3 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. And actually, it's making the whole system fall over because they can't cope with hundreds of students, as well as all the other people that come to the food bank. So there's a whole range of issues just that everybody else is experiencing. And the third one probably is around issues which we've had for a long time, which are sort of in the sort of criminal domain. So issues like spiking, which has been up and down, sexual harassment, online, you know, sort of cyberbullying, those sort of issues, which I'd say probably we're hearing a bit less of. Just after COVID, we had a real big increase in those, particularly in spiking incidents. But those are still issues that we will get through the door and obviously particularly affect women.
The Israel-Palestine conflict seems to be a topic that young people care deeply about at the moment. Is this something that you pick up a lot in the seat? And do you think Labour's position is one that young people are happy with currently? You know, it's changed in recent months.
But, I mean, what I say is, and it's much more broader than just students, in my constituents and my new constituents, if you like, the bit that I'm taking on that I don't currently represent, that there are really strong views on international issues. And actually, I would say probably in the country, it's one of the constituencies where people are most clued up and care about international issues. I just went door knocking on the street the other day where the first, I don't know, half a dozen houses, there were Ukraine flags on most of them, and people were still talking to me about Ukraine. People have been, you know, we have so many international issues. People talk to you about what's happening in Sudan, what previously has happened in Yemen, for example. Those issues are I really care about those issues as well. I get very involved in international human rights issues. And I think that's the basis of it, that people really care about people's human rights and resolving conflict around the world and want to see peace. And that's very much my background. That was, you know, from even before being a student, that was my approach. And I'm in a really unique situation in Parliament. It's a good thing for my kids to know this, that my parents came to this constituency, to Leeds Central constituency, from Israel. And my father was a peace activist in Israel. He was on the Israeli left, one of the first people, one of the first groups to call for a two-state solution for a Palestinian state. And that's been my enduring view. It is my enduring view. I called for a ceasefire and voted for one way back in November. Again, that's been my view, not just because of peace, actually. And I think I've been born out with this, that my strong view, and so my strong view, the only way for hostages to get released is through negotiation and through a peaceful settlement. And the one point where we had a ceasefire, although it was temporary, that's the only time that hostages were released. Military action isn't releasing those hostages. Those hostages need to go back to their families. Many of those hostages themselves were peace activists. I went in February to Palestine and to Israel. I went to the kibbutz. I visited the very first house attacked by Hamas. I met the son of the people that were living there who were killed by Hamas. I met families whose children are hostages in Gaza. I met people in the West Bank. I met people affected by settler violence, who are still affected by settler violence. I met the Deputy Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority. And my global view didn't change meeting all those people, and is still that we need to have a ceasefire. And we've already seen a sort of partial military withdrawal by Israel because they haven't managed to release any hostages, and they've absolutely destroyed Khan Yunis in the process. We need release of hostages. We need free flow of aid, and the whole issue of humanitarian aid has been a disaster in Gaza. We're seeing a mass starvation event going on there. And we then need the international community to come in and help rebuild Gaza, and we need to recognise a Palestinian state and do state building activity so they can have a proper state. And that's the only long-term solution. What I don't want to see, and what I'm really concerned about, is that we are going to collapse into a regional war. We're already seeing high levels of conflict on the northern border of Israel and Lebanon and Syria between the Israeli army and Hezbollah. And it could grow. We've seen, you know, the British Navy has been involved with the Houthis in the Red Sea. This is escalating in a dangerous way. And I think that my constituents don't want to see it escalate, and they want to see a peaceful resolution. And they do want to see those hostages returned, but they want to see people's lives being saved in Gaza and people being fed and not being killed. And that's where we all are. The Labour Party's vision, that's Labour Party's vision now. The sort of current big issue is around arms sales. The way that it works is you license arms for sale, including parts. And the Labour Party has asked the government to show their legal advice, the government refusing to show it. I don't know what the legal advice says. Obviously, you know, it's private legal advice. But the legal advice shows that that licenses shouldn't be issued because Israel's a contravention of international law. Then licenses shouldn't be issued and those arms shouldn't be sold. That's the Labour Party's view. So I think that's sort of where we are in terms of electorally. It's not come up particularly from students as much as I would have thought. People want to know your view, people want to know your position, people want to have a debate about it, but I've not had many conversations where people have said this is like the number one thing swaying, you know, how I'm going to vote or not vote. But you know, let's see.
And I guess for students as well, tuition fees are going to be a massive issue for them. I've spoken to Bridget Phillipson, your shadow education secretary, before, and I could not get an answer on what Labour will do about the problems in the system in terms of, you know, a massive overhaul. You know, Labour understands that there are issues with tuition fees, but in terms of a, you know, complete solution, it doesn't seem to have one. What's your view on what should be done here?
So I think, first of all, it's not one problem. It's at least three problems. So the problem is the one that you posted. What do you do about tuition fees now, £9,350 a year, which is meant to be the ceiling, but nearly everybody charges that now. For pretty much every course at every university. Then there's the debt. So this is the graduate debt and the high interest rates and the levels of debt, and the fact we have a perverse system where you effectively, your debt is cheaper the wealthier you are or the more you earn, and the less you earn, the more debt you have, although eventually it does get written off if you never reach a sort of ceiling. But it's a very perverse system. And then third one is maintenance support. So obviously loans for maintenance, but also should we have grants and bursaries? So it's three different problems. And if you resolve one, then what you're doing is creating inequity with another group. So if you resolve the issue of current tuition fees, which is what the last Labour leadership very much concentrated on, which was scrapping fees, which at that time was cost 11 billion. I think we're probably north of 13 billion now in terms of cost for that every year. Then that's not very fair on all of those who've been paying fees and have accrued debt for the last 25 years or so, although the ones right at the beginning, they won't have any debt anymore. But the point still stands, they paid their debt. So it's not as simple a problem as maybe you want to first come into it. And then there's the third problem about students from less well-off households and how they should be supported with non-repayable finance. In the old days, you'd call it a student grant. If you're just going to wave magic wand and resolve everything, it would cost north of £100 billion. And if you went to the electorate and said, what we're going to do, our first priority is spending £100 billion on students and recent graduates, that would be a very hard sell. You know, it'd be a bit like saying, well, all we're going to do is spend £100 billion on pensioners. Then again, young people would be like, well, that's not very fair. What about us? So it's a really difficult problem. For sure, a thing that would help right across the piece over time would be to lock down the interest rates. Interest rates, you were absolutely right, are far too high. They are, and also it's like you normally, if you take a loan, right, you get to shop around. You get no choice of the student loan. That is it. That's the interest rate. You can't shop around. There's no choice. It is what it is. So the government should actually, and because it's such a big pot, should intervene very strongly and reduce interest rates. And that would be fair across all groups, unless you then abolish fees. But in the immediacy, it would be the fairest thing, because those obviously who are graduating in the future would come into the debt and the interest rates, and they come in at a lower point. And everybody paying now, they'd then start having their payments reduced. Might be a little bit unfair on those who have finished paying off, but actually, if you look historically, when we started this, interest rates were lower. So it's a more, I would say that the interest rate thing is a more recent phenomenon. I think probably nearly everybody who is paying student debt higher level is still paying student debt higher level. So there's a bit less inequity there. But I think that my view has always been that we should aim for a free system. Education adds to the wealth of the nation, particularly in a post-industrialized economy. The biggest difference we're going to have in this country is to have highly educated people and a highly educated workforce with good skills. And so why would we put a barrier there? That it's just how we get to a point of how do we pay for that and who pays for it. And I think we're at a point now where coming in and saying we're going to change the whole tax regime to pay for this group of people is difficult. But my view is that it might not be difficult for a long time, because once we start to fix the country, we can start having a much broader debate about things.
Young People and Labour's youth movement was galvanised in 2015 by Jeremy Corbyn, where his particular brand of left-wing politics chimed with the more idealistic approach to the world that a lot of young people share. However, following his departure from front and centre of Labour politics, the party has to keep a hold of young people to convince them that a duller, more pragmatic and Tory-friendly Labour Party deserves their vote this time around. I spoke to Ruby Herbert, the co-chair of Leeds Labour Society, who, since our interview, has been elected the national chair of Labour students, to get a bit more understanding of how young people in the party and in the city are feeling about politics and the Labour Party. Ruby, hello, and welcome to Pod's Own Country.
Hi, thanks, Mason. It's good to talk to you.
As a student yourself, obviously one that's quite politically engaged, what are the kind of things that people at the university and also in the city and, you know, the area around saying about politics at the moment? What are they concerned about?
Yeah, so Leeds Central and Headingley has Headingley and Hyde Park Ward, which is about half students in terms of its makeup. I think at the moment students' issues in a lot of ways are quite similar to the general public's, but the main issue that's really hitting students is the cost of living crisis. Students have had a really rough time over the past decade, and it's just been getting worse and worse as maintenance loans haven't increased with inflation, and now some of the biggest price rises we're seeing are in food, rent and bills, all of which are really affecting students in Leeds. I think other issues that are really important to students are things like the environment and also social issues, but the outstanding thing is just the cost of living. It's been really, really rough.
And one of the issues that I hear come up time and time again on this series is housing. And I guess for a lot of young people at the moment, this seems a very long way off as an idea in terms of owning your own home. Is that something that students are really thinking about at the moment?
Yeah, it definitely feels a long way off. The issues that we're facing with housing is students are just right at the bottom of the chain. So we're often the people who struggle the most with difficult landlords and poor quality housing for the prices that we're paying. So I think what's really got to happen is better renters' rights reform, which I know Labour is already trying to push through, and tightening up controls on safety and quality of housing. Home ownership is just so far out of students' minds, it feels completely unachievable, because we're not even really surviving in the situation when we're renting.
And obviously Labour had a lot of support from young people under Jeremy Corbyn, but do you pick up any resentment towards the party now, or is it still the case that, you know, young people are, you know, all about Labour?
An overwhelming number of young people are going to be voting Labour. Yeah, that's definitely the case. I think it's 70% of 18 to 34 year olds. So there is a lot of support. I think a big problem that we're seeing with students and young people is a general political apathy. And there is a feeling among some people that no party politics is going to work for them. But I think that that is a result of just continued decline throughout the past 14 years of Tory government. We've grown up just having governments that haven't worked for us at all. And I think that people will vote Labour because they are fed up with it. And I think we'll see, hopefully, a more positive attitude towards politics when we have a government who actually starts helping us.
And on tuition fees, what are the main issues here? We know there's a huge amount of student debt as an issue, but is there anything else that students are facing which, you know, goes a bit under the radar?
Yeah, I think student finance is a big issue, and students do feel like the system's really not working. We can tell it isn't. I think there's a few main problems. So one is that the assignment of maintenance loans is a very complicated and quite unfair system. So the government currently expects parents to top up student loans, and a lot of parents either don't realise that that's an expectation or can't afford it. Even the maximum maintenance loan has not matched inflation over the last decade. So students have been squeezed even more relatively to the rest of the population. So those two things really need to change. Just increasing the money that students can get to support their really high cost of living. And then when we talk about fees, I think one of the big problems is just the amount of interest that's put on student debt. It can be as high as 10%, which means students are paying back debts that are increasing even as they pay. So in 1 year, you might pay back less than is added. And I think it's that makes people feel like it's a really unfair system. They don't feel like they're being treated fairly. And I think they're the things that really need to change.
Labour's position on the Israel-Gaza conflict seems to have shifted a bit in recent months to one that seems to me, anyway, more akin to what young people have been calling for in previous months. But is there still a sense of frustration that the party's, you know, not going far enough from people around the city?
I think there is some frustration still. I mean, you can see that there's continued protests on campus about what's happening in Israel and Gaza. Obviously, we've all felt horrified watching it unfold. And I think there is a sense of powerlessness amongst people because, you know, the government aren't, and the Tories aren't really listening to certain calls. I think Labour has definitely, I think Labour's stance is very sensible, and it has changed. We are calling for a ceasefire. We started calling for a suspension on arms sales to Israel. And I think that is in line with what people want. I think some people that feel frustrated with Labour over this issue, it's the same people who have generally been drifting from the party since 2020. Labour's reformed in a lot of ways. And I think our foreign policy is an example of that.
In recent years, politics has got that little bit nastier, that little bit more adversarial. From the culture wars to mass protests, there is a lot of resentment in the UK at the moment. Young people in this country are angry for a lot of reasons. But chief among them is the simple, undeniable truth that for many of them, the life ahead of them is worlds apart from the one enjoyed by their parents and grandparents. This inequality between the old and the young is increasingly becoming a case of the haves versus the have-nots, with the future looking very bleak for millions of young people. Liz Emerson is the CEO of the Intergenerational Foundation, a charity dedicated to laying bare the uncomfortable truth of how good older people have things compared to young people. Liz, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mason, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, do you think it's fair to say that young people are, you know, right to be resentful of the future they've got to look forward to compared to previous generations?
I'm afraid so, Mason. And what's going to be interesting about this general election is how housing and the housing crisis is likely to be centre stage, because younger generations are just finding it so hard to cover the cost of living. And what older generations need to understand is that the tables have turned very much since they were young people. The average under 35-year-old needs to spend two-thirds of their weekly expenditure just on essential spending. That's housing, that's utilities, that's transport to get to work. Things like insurance for a car to get to work in the olden days used to be a couple of hundred quid. For an under 25-year-old to be insured on a car these days, it's costing around £5,000 a year. The costs have gone through the roof, and the work that we've done over the last decade has shown that the position of younger generations, the under 35s, in 9 out of 10 policy areas that we investigated have either stagnated or declined. Now, whilst that economic stagnation has been going on for younger generations, following the fallout of the global financial crisis, austerity, Brexit, austerity to the pandemic, inflation, war in Ukraine, where do we stop? The elephant in the room in all of this is that we've got very welcome but rapid aging of our population. So if you think of a triangle where in the old days you have a few older people who were supported in retirement by a larger base of a working age population, that triangle is changing. It's now more of a cylinder shape with a bulge at the top. And that bulge is older people who are living longer. That's great news. There are grandparents, there are parents. But what they're taking with them as they age is increasing wealth. And that wealth is tied up largely in housing and pensions. They are the wealthiest generation that have ever existed. And they don't like to be told that, because they're also the people who have been the major beneficiaries of the welfare state that was created by their parents right after the Second World War. So you've also, within that aging population, you've also got a baby bulge. So these were the generation of children that were born between 1945 and around 1965, who are called the baby boomers that older generations hate. And of course, there are arguments that the wider your cohort of births, the wider the group of people that you are in, the more benefits you get from the state. And it makes sense, because they need primary school places, they need midwifery places, they need secondary school places. And as they've gone through society under the pillar of this great welfare state, they've taken more spending with them. Now, the problem is, and this is where the intergenerational conflict is starting to arise, the problem is, whilst they were contributing, whether it's through national insurance or taxes, they went through the world of work, or contributing towards their pensions, the deal that they were being offered was really overgenerous for where we are today. So there's a massive shortfall in what their expectations of entitlement are in older age and actually where the money is. And so what's happening, sadly, is that successive governments, because older people vote more than younger people, are not telling the truth to older people. They're still telling them that they can have access to all these wonderful goodies once they reach a certain age. That comes with a cost. That cost is falling largely on younger generations through higher tax rates.
So how do we change this conversation to make it, you know, less adversarial between younger people and older people?
I think older generations need to be a little bit more honest with themselves, because this conflict isn't going to go away until they appreciate that they're actually doing very nicely. Thank you very much. I know. And I can feel the outraged callers about to hit the button with you, Mason. And the reason I say that is that over the decade or so that we've been working, we have seen the conversation go from, you lot are all ageist, you all hate old people and you all want older people to die quickly, because you are calling out a little bit of over-entitlement. So back in 2011, the very concept of intergenerational fairness was seen as a dirty word. How dare you question the social contract between the generations? I think that conversation has changed over the last decade as parents and grandparents are really starting to see, because the conversations are happening around kitchen tables up and down the country about just how hard it is for their kids or their grandkids to get on the housing ladder, to be able to move out of the family home. I mean, we've got 3.8 million grown adults having to live with their parents. So that's one of the things I would say. The other thing I would say is you need to better educate yourselves to understand just how unfair the system is. Let me just state very clearly, we absolutely get it that around 17% of over 65s are living in poverty. And they need help. Now, the level of poverty amongst older generations has actually fallen by nearly half since the 1990s. So we get that there is a group of older people that really need more benefits and protection. But that does not mean that all older people are in that situation. And previous IF research has shown, whether older people like it or not, that there are 3 million over 65s in this country out of 12 million over 65s who are living in millionaire households. And by that, this is our own research that we conducted. It's from the Wealth and Assets Survey. The next survey data will be out in a couple of months that we'll be able to update it. And probably that number of pensioner millionaires is actually going to have increased. And it's going to increase because we look at housing wealth and pension wealth. Now, the argument we get from older people is, hang on a moment, that's our house. You can't say that's wealth. We need to live somewhere. And that is where older generations are completely out of touch with how wealth has changed across the generations. Because actually, the average young person today hasn't any wealth at all. They're in minus wealth because they're having to pay so much towards their living costs.
And I know there's a real sense of annoyance from young people in terms of looking at some of the benefits that old people and pensioners get from the state. Do you think that there's any appetite to start, you know, means testing benefits for older people to make sure that they go to the pensioners that really need them rather than, you know, blanket across the board?
It's absolutely bizarre, Mason, that things like, I mean, so once you get to the age of 60, this wonderful world of universal benefits is open to you, if you get there. So, you know, I'm working, I'm calling you from London, I'm in London. In London, things like travel concessions are extraordinary. That once you get to age 60, you can get to travel for free on any transport in London. So what we're finding is that through previous IF research as well, we found that one in four people over 60 who are below state pension age are going to work for free alongside their younger colleagues. Again, why should you be able to get concessions when you go to a museum at age 60 when you're below the retirement age? That society and the government and so many institutions have not caught up with the need for people for state pension entitlement to catch up with actually what is old age in this country. If I said to somebody age 60, gosh, you're an old person, they tell me where to go. But here's a real unfairness, and it's how the government treats different generations. So, for example, the triple lock on the state pension today will go up this year by 8.5%. Working age benefits for those people that are struggling and can't find a job or are on universal credit, they are only going up by 6.7%. Students who are being hammered by £9,000 a year tuition fee and interest rates on their student loans currently of 7.7%. Can you see the intergenerational transfer going on there, Mason? Their maintenance loans, their living cost loans, are only going up by 2.8%. Now, that triple lock on the state pension, last year, it went up by 10.1% for every single pensioner, irrespective of their wealth. So over just 2 years, the state pension is going to increase by nearly 20%. The elephant, another elephant in the room in all of this conversation is, what is the state pension total liability? I think it's around £4 trillion. Pounds. Nobody wants to talk about that elephant in the room. And that is why governments are saying, well, we've got to do something about the state pension. So therefore, we're not going to do the brave thing. And this is cross-party, irrespective of Labour, Conservative or Lib Dems. They are not really dealing with the truth of the state pension at the moment with a triple lock, which is it is unaffordable. The question is, when is that triple lock going to change? And they have all weaponized the triple lock to gain the grey vote. And the argument then comes back to us over and again. Well, Liz, you know, older people vote, young people don't. So, of course, we're going to offer the goodies to older generations. And this is where I think this general election is going to be different. And this general election is going to be different because younger generations are more educated. They're increasingly more educated than older generations because more of them are going on to higher education. They're learning more about the world and they're beginning to see the unfairnesses, even in the world of work. I mean, I wrote an article for The Telegraph way back last year telling the boomers to get back to the office. Actually, the older generations have a duty to mentor their younger workers. If they want younger workers to be productive and to pay more tax through higher earnings, then can you get back to the office and train them, not sit in your garden conservatories thinking, well, this is all right, I'm having a great life, thank you very much. So in many ways, that social contract is under so much strain. But this general election is going to be about housing. And it's going to be about housing because if you are under the age of 50, you are 50% of you are probably going to be renting into old age. If you're under 35, you can only get on the housing ladder pretty much with the help of the bank of mum and dad. That is going to exacerbate intragenerational inequality. which obviously is inequality within generations. So it's going to make wealth disparities worse for younger generations in the future, unless we deal with the problem of housing. And people are going to fall off their chairs around Yorkshire when I say this. We have to talk about the Greenbelt, because the Greenbelt has more than doubled over 30 years, and it is strangling the economic prospects of our kids and our grandkids if we do not have a grown-up conversation about just how much new housing we need for younger and future generations. And all we're asking for is decent, affordable, safe, secure roofs over their heads.
Turning to student finance and tuition fees, from the outside it looks like, you know, quite an unfair system, but just how unfair is the current system that students are having to deal with?
Here's the first thing. The top 10% wealthiest students in this country are not even in the student finance system. They've paid their fees up front. Mummy and daddy are looking after their living costs. So they are basically free from a system for 30 and now 40 years. Okay, so on wealth grounds, all of this argument about it's progressive, Liz, and, you know, the architects that built the marketization of higher education, that young people should contribute more towards their own education, is built on a lie. Okay. The second thing on student finance is that we already have a progressive tax system where the more you earn, the more you pay. So again, on that argument, the current system doesn't work. And here's the third really uncomfortable truth. The graduate premium, which was promised to young people before the tripling of tuition fees, no longer exists for most graduates. For recent graduates that graduated over the last 5 years, around 46, 47% of them are working in non-graduate jobs. For those graduates that graduated more than 5 years ago, 30% of them are working in non-graduate jobs. Meanwhile, the rung has been pulled, the ladder has been pulled by employers who use having a degree as an easy way to cut applicants for their jobs. So again, we've got to have a national conversation about whether university education is the right way to go for most people. If, as long as called for it to be a public good, we believe in education as a means of social capital that should be invested in along with our progressive tax system, and a return to block grants and maintenance loans for the poorest students. Another really uncomfortable truth within our current student finance system is that it is the poorest students who will be borrowing the most, obviously, and paying back the most, obviously, over the longest period of time. So the idea that it's progressive is a myth.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you liked what you heard, then subscribe to the Yorkshire Post for more interviews and analysis from me this weekend. Next week, I'm off to the seaside. I'll be in the Tory seat of Bridlington and the Wolds, the oldest seat on our list, and what should be a safe Conservative constituency in any normal election year. I'll be unpacking whether the core Tory vote will hold up and explore the key issues facing older voters ahead of polling day. See you then.